Good morning. Welcome to the November 14th, 2018 Delta Stewardship Council. I'd like to call this meeting to order and begin with the roll call. Beginning on the far right with Council Member Weinberg.
Weinberg here, present.
Yeah, here.
Moronian here.
Fiorini here.
Tatayan here.
Simpson here.
Very good. We have a quorum, and I understand Council Member Gatto is en route, so we will see him later on today. Next item is file item number 3, closed executive session. I expect that will take about 30 minutes, so we will now recess to closed session and be back somewhere around 9:30. Good morning. We are reconvening an open session. I have nothing to report out of our closed executive session. The next item, file item number 5, is the adoption of the October 23rd to 26th meeting summary. And council members, a revised copy has been circulated. There one change, it was a reference to one of the covered action projects that was reported on. What's your pleasure regarding the meeting summary?
Second.
Question. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Then let's vote. Ken?
Weinberg, aye.
Damrell, aye.
Moronian, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Tatayan, aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much. All right, on to file item number 6, the chair's report. The first thing I wanted to comment on is we're all aware of the smoky conditions that we've been suffering through, and that's nothing compared to the tragedy that has befallen folks in the Paradise area and the Malibu area. And I just wanted to express our heartfelt concern to those who have lost or are missing loved ones as a result of this devastating fire in the Paradise area. The governor was on the television over the weekend with Cal OES and Cal Fire and local officials describing conditions, and I thought the governor used a term that makes a lot of sense, and that is that this is the new abnormal. The conditions of drought and it's just so sad to see the devastation that's occurred, and I hope that I hope the best for our firefighters and for those families that are mourning the losses. The next thing I wanted to talk about, we had the latest Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting that was held in Sacramento on Monday, November 5th. It was well attended, a full agenda. I would like to call upon Amanda Bowl, our coordinator, to give you an overview and then also provide Dr. John Calloway and Skip Thompson, members of the DPIC, opportunity to share any thoughts they have. And Susan was in the audience. You may have some comments. So, Amanda.
Great. Thank you, Chair Fiorini, and good morning, Council members. So as Chair Fiorini mentioned, the 10th DPIC meeting was held last Monday in Sacramento. The meeting continued the DPIC tradition of considering how these 17 agencies can continue to support implementation of the Delta Plan and the furthering of the co-equal goals. Last week's meeting focused on 4 key areas with presentations and then discussions. The first item up on the agenda was focused on furthering the state and federal nexus. The U.S. Government Accountability Office recently released a report discussing federal coordination throughout the entire watershed. DPIC was highlighted as a key coordinating entity in the Delta. The report's authors were in attendance at the meeting and provided an overview of the report. And the committee then discussed the need for DPIC to continue in this role and how we can continue to strengthen existing coordination between the Bay and the Delta and the entire watershed. The second area of focus was on current restoration efforts. So Ron Melser from our staff provided an overview of the Delta Plan ecosystem amendment process, and then a representative from the Department of Water Resources was attended the meeting on behalf of the Resources Agency to provide an update on EcoRestore. We also heard two presentations on simplified and multi-agency permitting. We had someone from Sustainable Conservation provide a presentation on efforts in the Delta, and then Larry Goldsband, who is the Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, to talk about an approach, a slightly different approach that they're taking in the Bay to multi-agency permitting. So committee members, after we had all these presentations and between the presentations, really discussed various aspects of restoration, and the committee members expressed interest in diving into and finding solutions for the continued challenges around funding for operations and management, permitting, and monitoring. So we look forward to continuing those discussions at future DPIC meetings. Delta lead scientist John Calloway presented an update on Delta science program efforts, and then Yumi Henneberry from our staff provided an overview of the updated Delta Science Plan. The committee was then asked to endorse the updated Delta Science Plan, which it did so unanimously. The final panel discussion focused on invasive weeds and nutria. We've had presentations and discussion around invasive weeds at DPIC in the past, but had never had an update on nutria. And as we've mentioned at previous council meetings, it's an issue of huge concern in the Delta. Noting the urgency of dealing with nutria, committee members agreed to form a high-level interagency committee to identify immediate steps that DPIC agencies can take to start to address this issue. And so we're starting to pull together that committee now and look forward to working with the other DPIC agencies that are engaged in this to try and elevate this issue and direct more resources to the nutria effort. Finally, I'm excited to announce that we're actually adding an agency to DPIC. The San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, also known as BCDC, has been asked and has enthusiastically agreed to join DPIC. BCDC and the Stewardship Council have overlap in Sassoon Marsh, and the inclusion of BCDC continues to recognize the need for greater coordination and collaboration between the Delta and the Bay. And then we're also working with BCDC and collaborating with them on some of our sea level rise and climate change work that we're doing currently. So we look forward to working with them more closely as well.
So. Great. Thanks, Amanda. Any questions of Amanda? John, comments?
Yes. So as Amanda said, the science plan update was discussed at the DPIC meeting, and we got good feedback in terms of the approach and the efforts that the update is leading towards. So I think we were very happy to get their endorsement of the science plan and concept. Other issues I think that were of interest, the funding, Randy discussed the funding initiative, the science funding initiative that has been taking place over a number of months, and that will be presented to the DPIC in April. And I think there was real awareness of the value of that funding effort and a strong understanding of the linkage between funding and governance issues that we've talked about, and that's a part of the science plan, and awareness to really move both of those issues of coordinated governance and funding forward. The nutria issue, I think also, as Amanda mentioned, really it was very important that people see the urgency and the need to address the nutria issue, and I think this coordinated effort will move us forward and provide some of the resources that will, or identify the resources that will be needed to address nutria. And then lastly, one thing that came up in the discussion around the GAO issue, and actually came up multiple times in the meeting, was the Bay Delta watershed issue connections and the real value of looking at these problems. It is the Delta Plan Implementation, Interagency Implementation Committee, but linking to those broader efforts and the incorporation of BCDC, the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, will be a good link towards the Bay. We need to think about how we can keep focused on the Delta, but coordinate with those efforts in the Bay and the watershed.
Thanks, John. Skip?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always encouraged when I see the federal government wanting to work with local government. And, you know, as you get closer to the ground, as I'll use the term, the more understanding you have about what is actually going on. So I saw a real desire from the federal agencies to work with certainly the state, but DPIC, which I think is getting down. And then those of us that work, you know, representing the Delta specifically, we have some ideas, and I think they'll be able to be fleshed out with the help of the DPIC and Delta stewardship. So I saw it as an encouraging, omen, if you will. But anyway, thank you.
I have to say that this last DPIC meeting, I saw much more enthusiasm than I had seen at the previous one, and it was really heartening to see, as Skip said, the federal folks engaged the way they did. The only other item I heard, in addition to what folks have already talked about, is the desire for synchronized or more coordinated communication, the concept that if we're going to coordinate on the science plan, we should be coordinating on the funding stream, and our messaging should be, I didn't hear that the messaging should be exactly the same, but we should be checking in with each other about what we're saying about these projects that we're all working on. But it was a really good meeting.
So this was the 10th time the DPIC has met. There's a handout, an eight-page color brochure that has been prepared that explains the role of DPIC, and it describes some of the achievements that have occurred over the last 5 years. It's been an honor for me to be a part of this from the beginning, and I highlighted at the meeting Taryn Ravazzini, Jessica Law, and now Amanda Bull have been outstanding coordinators, and much of the success that this group has had is a result of the staff effort to organize, to help create the agendas, all the follow-through that occurs between the meetings. So I think I'm leaving this work in really good hands, and I've appreciated the opportunity to serve. Any comments or questions? Any requests for comment on file item number 6? Great. Okay. Well, it's a good segue to file item number 7, council election of chair and vice chair. As some of you may know, my service here is term limited as your chair. No applause, please. I have a part-time role that will continue beyond the end of this year, but we need to select a new chair and a new vice chair. And this selection will become effective in January of this next year. So what is your pleasure? Councilmember Damrell?
Mr. Chair, I would like to nominate for our chair, Susan, our vice chair, who everyone has worked with. I think everyone admires, because she has one of the most even-handed, approachable, thoughtful manner about her that makes her ideal for this position. In addition, you know, her background is pretty remarkable. I mean, she's held policy positions at DWR, policy positions at the Bureau of Reclamation, and head of the Nature Conservancy. I mean, that's kind of covers all the bases in a sense. So she has a great perspective and a marvelous way about her that I think will make a truly excellent chair for this organization. As an ancillary thought I had, I don't know if this is kosher, but I think continuity at this juncture in our history is extremely important. And I would like to nominate also Randy, our current chair, as vice chair, because I think working together with Susan, he can provide assistance and help in a variety of ways. And I think now we really need that continuity. And I think that if we nominated both, and that's what I'm doing, as chair Susan, as vice chair Randy, I think it makes a lot of sense. So I don't know how to do this, Randy, but I would like to nominate both you and Susan as our chair, and you as the vice chair. That's my motion.
Is there a second?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I would like to concur with the comments that the judge made, and I would concur with you know, the continuity issue and how qualified Susan is to take this job, and the continuity with you being the vice chair. So I would like to second this motion.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. We're going to take public comment if there is any after the council has. Ken, you look like you want to say something.
Well, I don't know. Do we need a motion to close the nominations?
Let's. Is there any public comment on the matter? All right.
Motion to close the nominations.
Second. Okay, and to cast a unanimous ballot. Is that part of it? No. Okay.
No. The nominated slate of candidates.
Okay. Okay. Nominations are now closed.
Is this first time ever. Unanimous.
might be. Do I have a second?
So there are two motions. So you need a vote on the motion to close, and then a motion on the judge's motion.
I need a second for the motion to close.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second to close the nominations. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no? All right, that's so ordered. Now we're to the motion for nominating Susan Tatayan as our chair effective in January, Randy Fiorini as the vice chair.
Weinberg, aye.
Dammer, aye.
Maronian, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Aye.
All right. All right. The motion passes unanimously. Thank you all. And congratulations, Susan.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Okay, that completes file item number 7. Thank you for term limits. And now on to file item number 8, ecosystem amendment update, and I believe Jessica Law.
I think I'm going to quickly do the executive officer's report, if that's okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we are going to fast forward to file item number 9, if everybody is so inclined. Okay, file item number 9, executive officer's report.
Okay, good morning. Thank you. In addition to the current WaterFix appeals process, the council has 2 certifications of consistency that have been filed on our website within the last 30 days. Last month, I mentioned the Department of Water Resources North Delta Flood Control and Ecosystem Restoration Project. They filed a certification of consistency for that project. I believe it was October 25th. And the 30-day review period of the project ends Monday, November 26th. The San Joaquin Area Flood Control Agency filed a certification of consistency with the Delta Plan earlier this month for the Smith Canal Gate Project, and the 30-day review period ends Monday, December 3rd. The agency is the proponent for the project. The project is a fixed wall and gate structure at the mouth of Smith Canal, which is adjacent to the San Joaquin River and the Stockton Deepwater Ship Channel, and it's in the city of Stockton. The project is for flood protection. The existing levees along Smith Canal cannot be certified as meeting Federal Emergency Management Agency standards or the state's urban levee standards, and adjacent urban areas are currently at risk of flooding. Information about both of these covered actions and their detailed certificates are available on the council's website. A few individuals have recently joined our staff. Dylan Chappelle has joined as a senior environmental scientist coming from the California Council on Science and Technology, where he worked as a committee consultant with the California Assembly Natural Resources Committee. He has experience working with UC Berkeley and Point Blue Conservation Science, National Science Foundation, and Save the Bay. He graduated from UC Berkeley with a PhD in environmental science, policy management, and has a BA from UC Santa Cruz. His dissertation was on the influence of climate and seed dispersal on restoration in the San Francisco Bay. Carla Foreman will be assisting the council's legal team as a senior legal analyst. She comes to us from the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing.
Carla holds a paralegal degree from the University of Northern California here in Sacramento, and we look forward to the assistance that Carla will be providing to our team. Avery Livingood, who's here in the audience, has joined as a senior environmental planner. She comes to the council all the way from the Philadelphia Water Department, where she supported implementation of Green City Clean Waters, the city's 25-year plan to meet federal and state water quality standards. Avery holds a Master of City and Regional Planning from the University of North Carolina and a Master of Environmental Management from Duke University. Avery will be providing valuable assistance to the team supporting our ecosystem amendment, the 5-year review of the Delta Plan, several new covered actions, and our ongoing coordination activities with agency partners. So I'd like to welcome Avery.
Is she here?
She is here. Give a little wave.
So how did you deal with basketball season?
And with that, we do not have a legal or a legislative report today, so I conclude my executive officer report unless there are any questions.
Any questions of Jessica? Any requests for comment on this matter? Have we assembled all of the panel members, or do we need to go to lead scientists? Okay, we're good. Then that completes file item number 9, and now on to file item number 8, and it looks like Jessica Law is going to facilitate the introductions.
And I'll open up with a few words.
Thank you.
So previously we briefed you on the science that we're relying on to propose changes to the Delta Plan's ecosystem chapter. We prepared 3 white papers earlier this year on topics covering ecosystem function, climate change, and other stressors to the Delta's ecosystem. In August and September of this year, we described for you a potential approach to identifying and prioritizing the physical characteristics of habitat that we understand will achieve the ecosystem function necessary to fulfill the vision of both the Reform Act and the Delta Plan. Today, we will talk to you about logistics, the institutional challenges of restoration. In other words, why is it so difficult and time-consuming to get restoration projects on the ground? What are the political constraints, the legal constraints, the process or the bureaucratic constraints, and what are the opportunities? What strategies can the council and its partners undertake or promote to affect change through our Delta Plan amendment and through the way we implement the Delta Plan with our partner agencies? So that's what we'll explore today with an informative local case study to provide food for thought and learn from the unique expertise that comes with comes from experienced practitioners. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jessica and Ron.
Okay. Thanks, Jessica. Good morning, council members. We are very happy to be here today talking about this next phase in the ecosystem amendment. As you know, we've been hard at work on various components of building the ecosystem amendment, and today we're going to really focus on the institutional and implementation aspects of it. So I think we have a PowerPoint. We can get started. So today we're going to, hang on 1 second, let's get that loaded.
Thank you.
Thanks. I wonder if I have a clicker.
Billy's on it.
That's all right. So today we're going to talk about, one, review the progress to date, and where we've been, and talk a little bit about where we're headed over the next few months. Thanks so much. We're going to talk and review the ecosystem amendment, both the context that's in the Delta Reform Act and in the 2013 Delta Plan and the vision moving forward. And then we're also going to focus on implementation and our approach to implementation that we're proposing today. And we would really like feedback from the council members on our approach that we're taking to implementation. And throughout this discussion, we're going to focus on the practical aspects and some case studies of restoration, both in the Delta and around the Delta, and look at really what it takes to get restoration projects in the ground and successful. So just a quick review of progress to date. So we've been working on this for about a year. We started out with listening sessions and outreach last fall, presentation to the council on the scope of the amendment. Last February, we were really working hard on the synthesis papers and released a draft in February at a council presentation and then also a workshop in Walnut Grove. March was the release of the three synthesis papers that have really helped lay the ground for best available science and implications and considerations for the policies and recommendations in the amendment. And then continuing on with presentations to the council in July, and then, of course, August and September, here we are today talking about the institutional and implementation aspects. And then we'll be back in February with a presentation to the council on the full draft chapter. So the next time you see material, you'll have the entire narrative and policies and recommendations and performance measures in front of you. Then next spring, we plan on doing additional public outreach, including a public workshop, and we'll continue to move forward the amendment process and initiate CEQA in early spring. So at August and September, the last council discussions, we really focused on the physical and priority aspects of priority aspects of restoration. So we talked a lot about tiering and sort of what it takes to do these really sort of large multi-benefit restoration projects. And when we discussed this, we asked the council to think about a few approaches. So the amendment is really taking an approach where we're going beyond mitigation and looking at restoration overall. We believe that this is what's required based on the Delta Reform Act. We're emphasizing ecosystem function, addressing sea level rise and subsidence reversal, and really trying to leverage recovery and conservation plans. Ron will talk about that a little bit more and talk about BDCP and without BDCP, how the amendment plans on addressing large recovery and conservation plans. And then looking at restoration and conservation opportunity areas, building off of the work that the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has done on the conservation framework. At the September meeting, we discussed existing policies that are in the amendment and proposed changes. This is just a summary of the policies that we already discussed in September. So there is no change to two of them, ERR1 and ERP1, that have to deal with functional flows. We're proposing changes to ERP 2, 3, and 4 to update map and technical information, including an update to an appendice. And then proposing that ERP 6 be a new policy that really gets at that tiering and priority actions on the landscape. All of the work that we've been doing over the past few months is really helping us move forward and making progress on the amendment. So we're continuing to refine problem statements, develop a new Appendix 3 and content that will include technical updates to the maps. We're continuing to meet with state and federal agencies and interested stakeholders to discuss this approach to restoration, and then developing Chapter 4 narrative based on the approach and the feedback that we've received so far. So that's where we've been. I'll let Ron talk about where we're headed next and what we want to talk about today.
Good morning, Chair, Council members. So, as Jessica said previously, we've been focused on the more physical aspects of the system and the priority actions, where we have been in a space in the past month where we've been focused more on the institutional or bureaucratic aspects of restoration. These are, you know, related to the governance and agency alignment and permitting, funding of restoration projects. So today, I think we really wanted to lay the groundwork before we take a deep dive into existing policies and recommendations in the plan and visit a few example projects, also have Steve give a presentation and discussion on the Sassoon Marsh and the management plan that's being implemented in that region as a foundation for discussing the actual policies and recommendations in the Delta plan in the future. And this is a pretty complex, I think you all know, complex and important part of the amendment. I think the issues around governance and long-term funding are some of the more difficult issues to resolve and to the crux, I think, as we see it, of the amendment. And so hopefully today's discussion really gives us a strong foundation and an understanding of the various aspects of this part of the restoration equation. And so with that, just a quick step back. We've visited this slide several times now, including at the DPIC presentation, but this is the guidance provided by the Delta Reform Act, or at least a subset of it. It's very explicit in terms of the outcomes of restoration, the strategies that would be used to achieve those outcomes, and then guidance on use of best available science, on performance measures, and on a need for adaptive management in the equation. And so we are always starting from this point in working on the various aspects of this amendment. The other important foundational piece is the vision that the 2013 Delta Plan gives us. And again, that is a resilient and functioning estuary surrounding terrestrial landscape capable of supporting viable populations of native resident and migratory species with diverse and biologically appropriate habitats, functional corridors, and ecosystem processes. I think we've heard over the past several council meetings that we really need to walk this out and add definition to this. We're anticipating that our additions and proposed amendments on the physical aspects will really lay that out. So again, today we're hoping to touch on the institutional aspects that underlie achieving large-scale restoration, these Tier 1 and Tier 2 projects, as we've talked about in previous meetings. So in the current Delta Plan, we've also discussed prior that it was written in the context of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan with an expectation that plan would move forward as an NCCP, a Natural Community Conservation Plan. It was focused on addressing both the mitigation needs for the state and federal water projects, but also it was intended to achieve recovery of the covered species, and it had actions within it that addressed that goal. So the Delta Plan really provided some high-level guidance on restoration and focused on really protection of the opportunity areas that were being studied through the Bay Delta Conservation Plan process. The BDCP gave us a set of agencies that were to implement the plan and the actions. It provided a pathway for funding. It provided pathways for permitting. And so it really put a lot of structure around the institutional aspects. And with the state's pivot to eco-restore in terms of the restoration aspects of the landscape, there's a gap currently in governance, in the long-term funding, in how we're looking at permitting. And so this is an aspect of the amendment that we've been really focused on working on developing content that would address that gap by the pivot. So specifically, in terms of the amendment, again, the physical aspects of the amendment would address the priority restoration actions, conservation targets focused on ecosystem uplift. For that component of the amendment, we look to the recovery plans and existing conservation plans. The mapping, technical map updates address the where, regional land use, land ownership, and landscape suitability in terms of elevation and proximity to water. We're addressing multiple time horizons. And then the how really is the implementation aspects of the amendment. So facilitating implementation through improved processes and agency coordination. So wanted to take a step outside of the Delta. I think we spend a lot of time talking about projects within the Delta and also lots of focus on Eco Restore. If we think about the Central Valley landscape, as we've walked out in the synthesis papers, this landscape really connects the headwaters in the mountains, the transition zones of the river systems, the delta, and out to the marine environments, the bay area, and then the pelagic environments offshore. And the delta plays a really crucial role in that river system and wetland system. It's obviously the intersection of the largest river systems in the state, and there's been a lot of focus and some progress throughout the greater watersheds. I selected a handful of examples where Tier 1 level restoration is either has been implemented or is in the process of being studied and implemented. Many acres on the middle Sacramento River have been restored, floodplains reconnected. The Feather River has had significant setbacks of levees and, again, real focus on geomorphic process, on vegetation being reestablished. The Cosumnes River Preserve, the Middle San Joaquin has had specific restoration actions. We also look downstream to the Sassoon Marsh, the North Bay Salt Pond restoration actions, and the South Bay Salt Pond. So we've selected a few of these just to walk out a little bit in more detail. These are all, again, large-scale restorations with a focus on geomorphic processes, so river processes, wetland processes, and reestablishing vegetation, so true ecosystem restoration. So the first is the Cosumnes River Preserve, initiated in 1987. It's a large-scale collection of parcels focused on river and wetland ecosystems. At current day, it's on the scale of 50,000 acres, both within the delta and upstream along the Cosumnes River. So from an institutional aspect, interesting aspects about this are the partnerships that exist and the multiple agencies that both own land and engage in the all stages of the formation of the preserve. So study, acquisition, the restoration, and the long-term management. The preserve is currently updating their management plan through a collaborative effort of multiple agencies. The preserve has a rich history of addressing uncertainties through experimental restoration and monitoring. It really is a pillar of understanding uncertainties and exploring ways to perform adaptive management. Issues have been addressed, such as mercury and vegetation dynamics, non-native species management, and then modeling of specific species. The council has heard from various researchers on exploration of how fish are responding to floodplain restoration there. And birds and mammals have also been explored and studied on the preserve. Each of the components as the preserve has been built out are obviously expensive and have required creative funding in terms of, again, combining multiple funding sources, really predicated on partnerships making that work. And it's really within the Delta a model of success for multi-agency implementation. Sorry, council member.
That's fine. It's interactive.
Yeah, sure.
So, Ron, would this restoration project, this would be kind of what we would, or what you would call a tier one project. It's that high priority restoration.
So within the Cosumnes River Preserve would be considered a collective of tier one restoration projects, and really it's at a sub-regional scale, the preserve at 50,000 acres. But yes,
could you remind us of what are those attributes that make it a tier one?
So stepping back to our previous council meeting, tier one projects include the restoration of physical processes and biological processes. So things such as floodplain inundation, erosion and scour of natural channels, the reestablishment of native vegetation. They're large scale. They contribute in terms of habitat complexity and connectivity. And so they meet all of these aspects. Tier two meeting some, and further down where tier three and four may just contribute at a very small scale or only address a single attribute.
So this is an example of the highest priority type of project. And the objective of this project, I mean, you know, it's sort of, what was it aimed at? A single benefit, a single species, or is this an example of functionality that you want to, so that you get multiple benefits?
Excellent question, and it really addresses multiple benefits. The Cosumnes Preserve is focused on this process-based tier one-like restoration. There are managed wetlands and agricultural operations that support activities at the preserve, so they generate financial revenue. They also support wildlife species. And so wildlife-friendly agriculture is an important part of the preserve as well in terms of its meeting its conservation objectives. And one could also add that flood risk reduction is part of the benefits of the preserve in terms of the changes to capacity of the river systems by removing levees.
Is there a single success that we've seen out of this in terms of, you know, what has it enhanced the food web? Is that the main, or is it provided, you know, shelter from predators, or how would you frame some of the major achievements that we should note on the project, this project, or projects like this?
So I think it's supported by many stakeholders and has really engaged society and become an important part of the tourism and recreation in the Delta. Mm. There are many benefits from an ecological standpoint, both to the salmon populations that exist in the Delta, the bird communities, both the native bird communities and some of the more rare endemic species that would have bred in the Central Valley, but then also the wintering waterfowl and cranes. So ecologically, it's a really important location on the map. And then again, in terms of the flood risk reduction, downstream is not a very heavily populated area, but nonetheless, the projects such as McCormick Williamson and Grizzly Slough have a flood management objective to them, and so that is a successful implementation of a multi-benefit project.
And you mentioned mercury reductions or uptake of mercury.
And so again, from an adaptive management and a science standpoint, I always like to think about adaptive management as we're focused on two things. One, learning how to do restoration better, and then also understanding if we're meeting our objectives with a given project, with maintaining the durability of that project, and within the Cosumnes there's been learning on both fronts. And so specifically on how to do restoration, one of many studies has addressed the impacts of mercury becoming available to species and what types of land use practice can remediate or address that issue. And so I think from a adaptive management aspect, much of what we understand about riparian systems in the Central Valley, the Cosumnes has contributed significantly to that.
Okay. No, thank you.
I have a question, if I may. My question might have, Ron, maybe a larger context, and I hope that it's relevant here. But, you know, we learn about all this stuff, and then we took a tour of the Delta, and it might be a question of governance, too. I don't know. And then we hear, you know, in the Delta that on the tour in the boat that that steelhead bass is being introduced, and then there's fishing magazines who advertise that and what they do to the salmon right before the screens, and, you know, we went to the forebay. And I'm just wondering, all this... I'm sorry?
Closer.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering that, you know, when we hear all these reports here and then we go out and we see that, it might be an issue of governance. It sounds to me like, okay, how do these two come together? And how does all this big research that we do here and all these mm-hmm. plans and everything translate into real world where, you know, the fishing magazines do that and whatever body allows the introduction of steelhead bass and what happens to the salmon? Can you shed some light on it if possible? And I know it's a larger context of a question, but I think I'm just feeling like we're responsible to at least ask some of those mm-hmm. questions.
Sure. So one thing we need to remember is that the estuary is one of the most well-studied estuaries. It's also significantly impaired in terms of the attributes that we've been talking about in the tiering system. So both the connectivity between water and the landscape, the levee systems have really, and the reclamation of the land has disconnected the river system from the landscape. The other is the extent of habitat and native vegetation. So these are the core strategies of the Delta Plan, the land-water connection, the hydrology, the native vegetation, so the habitat core strategy. These are really significant impairments and reduce the area available to wildlife. And in that context, stressors such as predators, non-native species, water quality, become really important mm-hmm. because there's such little ecological space or such little habitat for the species to capitalize on. Their populations are reduced due to those more legacy stressors. So I think we focus a lot on studying the impacts of impaired populations and where we've really tried to go with the amendment is taking a step back from looking at issues that are these very discrete stressors such as, you know, predator impacts to fish populations and think about the issues that are legacy, that are more fundamental, and really put together an amendment that focuses on restoring some of the basic needs of the population. So again, expanding the space that they can capitalize on the landscape, making sure that land and water are talking to each other, that they have vegetation communities that create the structure and complexity. In that context, populations can grow, survivorship increases, and the more fine-scale stressors become more compensatory rather than additive, and I think species have a chance to do fundamental things like have evolution work, have recruitment into the next year where again, we see a response in terms of population level. I'm not sure if that's maybe Jessica could add.
I think one thing too is the bass, and John and Ron, please help me with this one, but bass fisheries is something that's much more characteristic of sort of warm water, deep freshwater lakes, which is much more common in areas where you have the big riprap levees. So we were down by the Clifton Court Forebay, you know, you have deep sort of, you have the riprap levees, you don't have a lot of sort of what Ron was talking about, that the ecological space where you would have availability, sort of room for the native species to be. So it's two very different types of environments. I think what we're talking about in terms of, you know, an example like Consumnes River Preserve is you're creating more space, sort of more landscape that looks less like riprap levees and places where you'd have bass fishing, and create much more space that would be conducive to native species. So it's sort of, you know, what we're talking about is very much sort of landscape change, moving from one habitat type to a different habitat type. Mm. And when you move from one habitat type to another, you create the ability for native species to thrive. Mm. Does that help?
It does help. But my question still, like, is that we can do all this, and there's overriding factors that no matter what we do, it doesn't help. I want to know where is our reach of governance that after doing all this, at the end of the day, we do all this and we still don't get results because they're overriding negative factors. Yeah. And is this one of those? And I just... I'm unclear on it, that I appreciate all this and I think we're doing a great job and we should do it as a body. But then how do we really fight these overriding factors? That's remains a question for me.
Could I just follow
yes.
up with that?
Right.
This is an example of remarkable success, the Consumnes River Preserve. And I note that the ownership of the land is in private, public hands, federal, state, local government. There must be a secret sauce in how you put this together. And in other words, this, I'm talking about governance, just exactly what I think Maria was referring to. I mean, what? How did you knit this together in a coordinated effort to do just what you said you did with this preserve? How did it happen?
And to be clear, I'm not taking credit for the Consumnes River Preserve. This is a model of success, and
we want to replicate that success.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the key question. And
I'm going to offer an answer.
I was not at the Nature Conservancy at the start of the Consumnes River Preserve. My understanding is there was no secret sauce. The biologists and ecologists at the Nature Conservancy at that time, and even during the early 2000s, did what they called conservation action plans. And what that means is they looked at a map and they looked for what levels of biodiversity exist where, and what are the threats, and what would the enabling conditions be to bring those habitats to a condition that would improve species viability for many species, not just fish, not just birds. And so the Consumnes is one of the few areas in the state where you don't have a dam controlling the flow regime. So it was a little bit more natural to begin with. And they worked through grants and private donations and willing landowners and the Bureau of Land Management, and the evolution of the preserve happened over a couple of decades. And it's just I don't know that there's a secret sauce, Judge, but I know that there were a lot of people on board with the concept of preserving this stretch, because it not only provides habitat, but it also provides functions such as floodplains. So you get both the benefits for birds and the benefits for fish, although there haven't been many benefits for fish lately. And the agencies, my understanding, I wasn't there, but my understanding is that the agencies actually gave grants and even in-kind services, and the Nature Conservancy worked very closely with the agencies. And in fact, the Bureau of Land Management is one of the more strong and assertive agencies that believes that this preserve needs to continue, along with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. But it was really a remarkable combination of creativity and people going after funding and agency individuals at agencies that championed and wanted this to happen.
And
I just wanted to go back to Maria, your question, which I kind of understood as, if you do all these things, you know, is it success, or are there other factors that can work against that?
Overriding.
Yeah, and I think there are, like water temperature. I mean, you could do all this, and then...
But water temperature is something that you don't control. But
that's
this
right.
is, yes. you know, again, goes back as a governance issue. As a council member, I'm on the boat, and I'm thinking, how discouraging. We're sitting here doing all this, learning all the science, and then we get here, and then somebody like does this tour and says, you know, the salmon gets slaughtered here because of the fish, and because of... I'm like, so what do we do about that? Or, again, goes back to a governance issue. Maybe right. we believe that we are, in the governance model, we're not, we don't have access to that, we can't do that, the sphere of our decision-making doesn't get there.
Right.
But it's very discouraging to be on that boat and see all that and come back here and hear all these great things we're doing.
Right.
But at the end, I don't want to simplify it, but you almost think, how much does it matter then?
Right.
Anyway.
So, no, I think you're bringing up some really important points, and the context, sort of the way that we frame those overriding considerations is, one, through adaptive management, right? You set your goals, you work towards achieving those goals, and then you look at the factors that either are outside of your control or within your control, and you manage to the ones that are within your control. I think that's one way. Once a project is in the ground and you start to implement, you're able to start to manage those factors as they come in and as they become significant. I think the way that we're looking at the amendment right now is, you know, these issues of partnership and leadership. So in all of these examples, we've got a few more to go through. There's definitely sort of a magic that happens when you have the right partners together, you have the right sort of political environment, and there's a synergy that's really created, sort of the right place and the right time. So that's a factor that necessarily we can't necessarily control, but we might be able to influence. So there's a few other factors too: funding, the ability to streamline and make permitting more efficient, and then the ability to manage through adaptive management. And so those are the factors that we're looking at as a part of the amendment. Those are things that we think we can in some ways control, and if not, at least have an influence over as a council.
So is it fair to say then that we are here to pretty much control the stuff that has to do with natural progression of things, or and then there are overriding factors that we can't do anything about it, no matter how mm-hmm. detrimental they are mm-hmm. to the life of, you know, the ecosystem or the delta or the species?
Yeah, I think as staff, what we're proposing is that there's two ways that the council can help control some of these factors. One is through our ability to regulate, and the other is through our ability to coordinate. And so we can regulate through our covered actions process, and ensure that projects, when they come in, they're meeting the tiering, they're meeting the criteria that's laid out in the Delta Plan. And the other way that we can control is through our coordination and our recommendations.
So in terms of the covered action regulation, is there mm-hmm. some stuff that we can, I mean, it would be helpful for me to look mm-hmm. at some of that, because I am not sure where they are and what it is, to mm-hmm. what extent can be exercised, how much effective can we be, maybe just because I don't
know about it, but yeah. It'll be helpful if I can sit with one of you and help me out to see what is the regulatory aspect of what this body does.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think two things coming out of this. One, a lot of the emphasis and the basis of these questions is getting at what are the drivers of change and the stressors on the system that we're trying to address. Jessica, I would recommend that we provide the council with the 2011 Independent Science Board's report on stressors. I think that'll help to provide good perspective on the types of drivers of change. You've touched on two or three. I think there's about 20 altogether.
Well, and even more recent would be our white paper from earlier this year that touches on some of those issues.
I think that would be some good foundational information. And then second of all, I think a briefing would be in order. The rest of the presentation is going to focus on some successes. And in particular, no pressure on Steve, but there's been some great successes in the Sassoon, Steve's here to talk about the opportunities and the challenges that he's observed in his tenure there. So if I think maybe it would be a good time to let Ron just race through the rest of the...
Sure, and I understand, and I don't want to take more of the meeting's time, but I understand the science side of it and the importance of this and all that. At the same time... I understand, and I'm thinking that no matter how much the science does, if the regulatory limits of, you know, this body doesn't allow, maybe, you know, there isn't much that you can do on the other side of this, and you can do small steps in, as you said, restoring, but you can't do anything about, you know, salmon being eaten by the bass at the forebay, you know. So... I'm just trying to get the lay of the land there of, you know, how much science, how much regulatory, and how do you really make an impact to the extent you can.
Appreciate that. And just one more time, I'll try with my point. The real constraint on species, and so salmon, is a lack of habitat. They aren't able to reach 80% of their spawning grounds due to dams. And below dams, we have a levee system that really constrains their rearing habitat. So as they're out-migrating, they're not able to grow to the extent that they would have historically. And so reestablishing that connection between land and water, and within that, having native vegetation that creates an active food web, structure, refuge for the species in terms of their out-migration. Those factors grow more fish, and the fish are bigger. And we've shown that at Cosumnes River Preserve. I say we. The science community has shown that. These are the changes that are needed such that the fish have a chance of surviving, of navigating the delta, of surviving the depredation, you know, both an increase in numbers and an improvement in their condition as they move through the system. And so I take a little more of an optimistic lens. The predation issue, it's an issue. It's especially important now where we have really reduced population numbers and the fish are in poor condition. But I think if we can, again, reestablish those habitat features, grow the fish populations, these specific stressors aren't, you know, the end-all, be-all of the species. And that's what we're trying to take a step back to these more legacy stressors and address those through the amendment so the discrete stressors aren't as big of an issue.
Sure. Thank you.
So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Very quickly, Jessica mentioned something that I'd like to change direction a bit. You mentioned coordination, that regulation coordination that this council has some effect. Now, as I was looking through the staff report, you talk about how the Delta Plan in 2013, when it was adopted, it was a more regional approach, and now we're taking a more focused approach on different projects. You know, I've often wondered how you do something on the north side of the delta, how it doesn't have a ripple effect as it goes through the delta. How are you going to focus on different projects and how they actually improve or restore the delta? How are these coordination efforts on the council's part going to be effective? How do you even know all the different projects and how they have an impact, negative or positive?
So I think that the question that you're getting at is really, it comes to governance, right? How do you measure success, right? How do you ensure that the regions have engagement from sort of local, state, federal that are really inclusive? How do you ensure that there's funding for either individual projects or regional projects? How do you assess the, and ensure that impacts of one project aren't precluding the ability of another project to perform? And I think all of those questions are really important. And one of the approaches that we're proposing is that you really need to be looking at things at a regional scale. The Delta is very large. It has lots of sort of smaller sub-habitats within it. And there's big differences between South Delta and North Delta and what's possible there in terms of restoration and project types. So the approach that we're taking is one where we're proposing that different project types are applicable within different regions of the Delta. So it's not a one-size-fits-all tidal marsh habitat within the central delta might not work because of subsidence, and but it might be better suited to other areas within the delta. So I think when we go through and start to talk about some of the governance approaches that we're looking at, I think that'll help answer, hopefully it'll help answer your question about sort of the approach to implementation of these projects.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. So I'll visit two other examples briefly. This has been a really good discussion that really hits on many of the aspects of these projects. I hope this figure is coming out a little better on the monitors for everyone. So within the mid-San Joaquin River system, I wanted to touch on a specific project, and it, again, this fits into a complex of Tier 1 projects on the San Joaquin National Wildlife Refuge. This specifically is called the Hidden Valley and Dos Rios Ranch Restoration Project, and it lies adjacent to a larger restoration called the Three Amigos on the San Joaquin National Wildlife Refuge. The next slide is an aerial of the project site. This summer, extensive planting was done on the Hidden Valley and Dos Rios parcels. So just to review the project and objectives. So two acquisitions, and again, it's a project and not the entire regional effort, which is not unlike Cosumnes River Preserve in its objectives to both restore the river system to connect water to the landscape, but also to implement wildlife-friendly agricultural practices and to support the operations and maintenance of the refuge through some of these agricultural practices. So the project is large scale, 2,100 acres. It's contributing to the greater region, which is approaching 10,000 acres of restored land. And similar to the Cosumnes River Preserve, there's a consortium of agencies, both public and private, that are working together to build upon the complex of properties within the refuge. These projects are obviously expensive, each one tens of millions of dollars, and so they take creative partnerships in terms of funding. 11 11 funding entities for the Dos Rios and Hidden Valley Ranch. Sorry, Chair.
Ron, do you have a reverse on your clicker?
Yes.
Can you go back to 19? That picture, just for the council's benefit, you see the river in the foreground. You see the dry ground to the right, and you see the spotty trees for almost as far as you can see. At the peak of last winter, that was entirely inundated with water, completely covered. So as an example of reconnecting the land-water connection, here's a somewhat channelized river. I mean, it's not, but it's been designed, this whole project has been designed to stimulate the food web and create the land-water connection. I didn't want to miss the opportunity to point that out in that picture.
So, interesting. There are several creative aspects to this project, which so the multiple purposes has been really important, both in flood risk reduction again, and then also in ecosystem restoration. Part of the Dos Rios and Hidden Valley Ranch. Project objective was also to create mitigation credits for flood system repair work, and so those are available in the San Joaquin Valley for entities that are undertaking improvements to levees or bank protection facilities. And again, similar to Cosumnes River Preserve, it's been a long-term effort where leadership and a focus on restoration has been underway by multiple agencies, and there's been diligent work on stepping through permitting processes and good progress just over the past several years in terms of implementation at this site. And I should add also, from the adaptive management standpoint, there's been on the San Joaquin River Refuge a similar long history of biological monitoring to assess vegetation dynamics, non-native species management, and also the response of endangered species. And so research has really informed restoration at these sites and informed the design of the most recent work. And the last large-scale regional project is the South Bay Salt Ponds. I could say a few things, and then maybe Dr. Calloway could add if he has other thoughts, but also large-scale multi-objective project focused on, again, connecting water and the landscape, reestablishing complexity in native vegetation and connectivity. It's large scale in nature, 16,000 plus acres, and a similar consortium of multiple agencies and creative funding from multiple sources, both public and private partners, and then federal, state, and private funding, and a real focus, again, on restoration as the project purpose. And the last, maybe, again, just touching on adaptive management, there's been experimental design in the implementation of the, or in the design of the restoration to date. It sounds like implementation is initiating at this point.
Yeah.
If I may ask.
Sure.
Ron, from the layman's perspective, mine, as you move from left to right, the second photo looks healthier than the one on the right. So kind of share with us which one is the healthiest and
I can share. So I've been involved a lot with the Salt Pond Project, and those pictures, the plant there is just a tiny little annual plant, and in September it's really big, and then it dies back in the winter, so it hadn't come in as much in May in the spring in the second picture there. But it shows you how the vegetation came in pretty dramatically, much more quickly than anyone expected, and creates the kind of interface like we've been talking about of the land-water interface that's really critical. So within just a few years, there was a pretty dense vegetation. The scale is hidden there. That creek is only probably as wide as this table. So it probably looks much, much bigger than you think. And one thing I was just telling Jessica is those pictures were taken from a kite. So they were taken before drones. 2010 was before drones were widely available. And a professor at Berkeley who was really into local aerial photography learned how to fly kites and float his really expensive 35-millimeter camera off the kite and take these really detailed pictures that were really valuable in as much as the science in showing people how things were changing. But a few other things about the Salt Pond Project. Like was mentioned, it definitely was multiple agencies. It was state and federal agencies. It was huge scale, as Ron mentioned. So the orange ponds there are still owned by Cargill and are managed for salt production. But the blue at the top and the green at the bottom were all purchased and are targeted for restoration. I'd say compared to the Delta, it definitely is a huge scale, 16,000 acres. It's the biggest restoration project, single restoration project on all of the Pacific coast. But it's much simpler than the Delta. There is an agricultural issue. So Cargill, who owns the land, always talks about farming salt, and they talked about the family farm salt production and that they gave up. But there wasn't. I think they realized the value of their land as salt for salt production was minimal, and the state and the feds purchased the land for a significant amount. So actually, Ron, if you go to the next slide, some of the things that Ron mentioned in terms of definitely large scale, definitely tier one in terms of linking up physical processes and connecting the bay to the land. It will more than double the acreage of tidal marsh in the South Bay, so it's an enormous landscape scale effort, but something similar that we have opportunities for in targeted locations within the Delta. The objectives that they were trying to achieve, or that they are trying to achieve, are to restore habitat, to maintain or reduce flooding for adjacent landowners, and provide public access and education. So it's relatively, simpler in terms of the focus. There's definitely an endangered species aspect, but there's not so much emphasis on fish. The water quality and the water flow issues are much simpler than in the Delta. Ron mentioned the research and monitoring components. So I think one really valuable thing about the Salt Pond Project was up front they identified what the real uncertainties were and what challenges there are in doing these kinds of projects up front. The uncertainties were mercury issues, so there's lots of historic mercury in the sediment. And then the balance of how to do the restoration. Should it be all marsh? Initially, everyone said just break open all the dikes and let it all turn into marsh. And then a lot of people said, well, what about the ponds provide a lot of benefits for fish, for birds, and for other things. So we shouldn't restore everything. We should think about a balance. But what balance is necessary, no one really knows. And so they're using adaptive management to guide that. And then also the other big uncertainty was the sediment. And if there is enough sediment to build up all those areas, because it's not as bad as in the Delta in terms of subsidence, but many of those areas are subsided anywhere from a foot or two to 3 to 5 to 6 feet. So how quickly it will build up, the picture shows you it actually built up much more quickly than anyone thought, but still there's uncertainty as you move forward. So I think in addition to our role in terms of coordinating approaches, coordinating science and identifying those uncertainties and moving the ball forward in that realm is something important to think about. And it does have a lot of public support. So there was $100 million that went to the purchase of the lands that Senator Feinstein was really instrumental in making happen. And then even more so, more recently, the local proposition, Prop AA, that the local communities, the nine counties around the bay agreed to tax themselves to provide funding to support restoration around the bay, and that's provided enormous amounts of money, not just for the Salt Pond project, but for overall restoration. And that really is, you know, something that the long-term funding is really critical. So I think those are all the things I wanted to add, Ron.
Thank you. So those serve as a few examples of some of the work that's going on in the Central Valley and out in the Bay. And hopefully that provides somewhat of a punch list of common attributes of these projects that, from an institutional perspective, that seem to be present in these large-scale, successful efforts, both that multi-party and public and private partnership aspect, the multi-agency and multi-funding source aspect of these projects, the presence of strong science in each of them, and then again diligence and focused efforts around permitting. And I think these projects demonstrate that permitting can be completed, and it is possible to step through the regulatory frameworks that are out there and do large-scale change on the landscape. The San Joaquin River work was especially significant in this past summer. 700 acres were planted without levee setbacks within the San Joaquin River. And that required, of course, the flood board permit and a 408 permit with the Army Corps of Engineers. And so it is possible to permit large-scale restoration and in relatively efficient ways. And the last aspect, I guess, is you know, the multiple objectives. And I think we see restoration projects that are large scale have multiple benefits inherently. Many times flood risk reduction is part of the equation. Without specific elements of the project to address that, large scale restoration brings flood risk reduction in itself. And so, but multiple benefits, also an important aspect. And so these are the issues that we've really been exploring, and again asking that question: how do we come in at the right level of detail with the right focus, whether it be on a policy side or a recommendation side, and create an environment in the Delta from the context of the Delta plan that really encourages these types of partnerships to form and entities to assemble and address each of these issues around restoration. So hopefully I have not stolen your fire.
No, that's all right. Thanks. So I just wanted to run through. We've identified sort of four major approaches that we want to talk about. And there's a few other examples that we can throw in. I think Steve can really talk about these in practice and his experience of the Sassoon Marsh Plan. And so we can sort of focus a lot of the discussion and questions there with a very, you know, practical example of it. But we've been really looking at, one, how the council can help remove some of the barriers to implementation that would benefit both individual projects and these sort of larger regional efforts when they become possible, right? And this has definitely been a theme at the past several DPIC meetings. I think we've talked about, so this is a photo from the last DPIC meeting, and up at the table, you can't see them, it's their backs, but it's Erica Lovejoy from Sustainable Conservation and Larry Goldspan from the Bay Delta BCDC. And they're talking here about removing or reducing barriers for permitting for restoration projects. So we've been working with Sustainable Conservation. The council has provided funding to support some of these regional permitting efforts that or statewide permitting efforts that sustainable conservation is putting in place to assist restoration projects. So that's sort of one example of how the council, through DPIC and through our coordination with our other agencies, can help to start remove some of these barriers to implementation. Larry Goldspan there is talking about an effort in the Bay Area called the BRIT, Bay Area Restoration Regulatory Integration Team, which is another really great example of how when you bring agencies together, you can start to identify ways to make permitting for restoration projects more efficient and effective, and then start to remove some of the larger barriers. So we just want to talk about a few of these approaches and throw in a few more examples of where progress on this is already being made. Again, in the 2013 plan, the Bay Delta Conservation Plan had both targets for restoration, sort of these large-scale restoration projects. It also had a governance structure and a funding structure and a permitting structure that went along with it. So we are really talking about creating both large-scale restoration targets and performance measures for restoration, but then also talking about how you create the governance and the funding and the support for permitting absent BDCP. So this first topic, leadership and partnerships, so we're proposing an approach that seeks interagency alignment of restoration, planning and funding, and utilizes public-private partnerships, strong local stakeholder engagement, and leadership from the highest levels of government. I think in all of our outreach and work with the other agencies, we've heard that there's really sort of this magic mix of having the right people at the right place in the right time, having really strong leadership come out, whether it's from a local agency or from an NGO, and that you really need that leadership from the local level and then also at the highest levels of government. I think we've seen this example here with California EcoRestore, both David Okita and now Mike Roberts at California Natural Resources Agency. They've really been able to provide that level of leadership from the governor's office to help support implementation of the EcoRestore projects. That example also holds true in other states like Louisiana, where the governor has been very involved and supportive of restoration efforts and the Coastal Master Plan in Louisiana. So we're seeing that sort of mix of leadership as being a really important component and approach to restoration. You know, the two examples up here, Consumnes River Preserve, so again, that's leadership from a lot of both state, federal agencies, and nonprofits. And then again, Yolo Bypass Cache Slough, the example up there is the MOU that was signed in 2016, where, again, you have state, federal, local leadership, including reclamation districts that are working hand-in-hand to identify how to create a mix of projects, both short term, near-term, and long-term projects that really create opportunities for flood control, multi-benefit, and restoration overall. So the next approach that we're talking about is science support for restoration. So we're proposing an approach of restoration that includes use of science-based conceptual models to inform project design, coordinated modeling efforts to address critical research needs, and applied adaptive management, ensuring projects meet their project design. So I think a really good example of this is in Sassoon Marsh, and we'll let Steve talk about the AMAT, but also the Stewardship Council, the Delta Science Program, and a group of state and federal agencies have been working together on the IAMIT, the Interagency Adaptive Management Integration Team, and have been developing a framework for adaptive management in the Delta that would support restoration. So the amendment will talk more about that and how both the Council, the Delta Science Program, and other agencies working in the system can use science to support restoration, both to understand how to improve project design and remove some of the barriers to monitoring and adaptive management once these projects are in the ground. So the other example, or the other approach that we're talking about is permitting support for restoration. So we're proposing an approach to increase efficiency through programmatic permitting and establishing coordination groups with state and federal agency partners. Again, the discussion that we've been having at the DPIC meetings is a really good example of this. This is something that in 2017, we did a survey of the EcoRestore projects and asked the permitting agencies whether or not, one, they could commit to helping to help move the permits for the EcoRestore projects get through on the timeline that was needed, so by 2020. The agencies, for the most part, committed to getting those permits through and prioritizing them. And then they also identified a few ways in which efficiency could be gained by better coordination. So that was sort of one example that kicked off at the DPIC discussion. Then we've been making pretty steady progress on that as a topic at DPIC. There's also other examples of where there's potential for increased efficiency, like the photo up there is the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Regional Conservation Investment Strategy, or the RCISs, which create a process for improving permitting and mitigation of projects, restoration projects specifically. And then I think the final approach that we want to talk about and just is long-term funding. So funding is always an issue for restoration projects. From what we understand, it really restoration projects really require a mix of funding sources, both public and private, and it really requires sort of pooling resources in a very coordinated way. The chart that's up here shows sort of an estimate of what the gap is for restoration funding. So the Public Policy Institute of California came out with an estimate that was, you know, around $5 billion in terms of restoration funding that was needed. The BDCP estimate was around $4 billion. And, you know, by our estimate, the statewide funds, both Prop 1 and Prop 68, we have about $1 billion that's available right now. So there's really sort of a tremendous gap. This is not a gap that's filled overnight. You know, this is one of the estimates when you talk about Measure AA in the Bay Area. It was a 10-year process to get that measure put together and passed. It was a lot of really diligent work by the San Francisco Restoration Bay Restoration Authority to both identify what the need was for restoration funding and then to be able to propose the appropriate method to fund restoration. So Measure AA is a $12 per parcel tax, and it provides several million dollars in funding per year. I think it's about $50 million per year in restoration funding, and that will fund restoration for about 36,000 acres. So we're actually working and meeting with some of the folks in the Bay Area that have helped put that measure in place and who understand the economics behind what it takes to fund restoration. And I think there's a lot of examples and sort of analogies between how you need to fund restoration and what the cost benefits are and, you know, how you start to estimate what these things cost overall. And there's a lot of analogies between funding in the Bay Area and what could or couldn't be possible in the Delta. But overall, funding, both long-term funding and then funding for operations and maintenance, is a huge gap. And so we're starting to look at, and that really requires coordination across the agencies to look at what's available, dedication to keeping those funds coordinated so that you're really looking at the highest priority projects. And that's something, that's an avenue that we're working on and thinking about as an approach to the amendment. So.
I have a question.
Yeah.
May I?
Yeah, it's discussion time now.
Yeah. On the first of all, it was a great presentation. I just want to make sure Jessica and Ron, I mean, it was really good presentation. On the permitting issue, is there a, can you give us like, is this land use permits? What kind of, what are the mm-hmm. examples of permitting processes?
So California Environmental Quality Act, so CEQA permitting.
Okay, CEQA, got it.
Depending on if a federal agency is engaged, NEPA, Endangered Species Act, both federal and state, and then there would be, if a flood facility is involved, Army Corps permits. If wetlands are involved, Army Corps, EPA. So really the environmental components of the permitting.
And us overseeing that? Because these are, I mean, they have to do this no matter what. If it's CEQA, NEPA, and Army Corps, they have to do it. What is the additional layer?
So I think there's an opportunity, because the activities look quite similar, the types of things that we are implementing across the landscape, whether it's removing a fish passage barrier, reconnecting floodplains by levee setbacks, planting vegetation. There are opportunities to put programmatic permits in place, and Jessica was referring to the sustainable conservation work, which has done that for some of the endangered species permitting. There's also opportunity to put agreements together with the Department of Fish and Wildlife that would allow for mitigation crediting agreements to be developed and implemented, which would relieve restoration projects of their permitting needs for California endangered species. So there's essentially there's opportunity, I think, to make things more efficient. It wouldn't be that we would be providing oversight over permits, but rather helping proponents step through their requirements through both coordination and putting in place mechanisms.
Thank you.
Thank you, staff, for a great presentation. You know, and the two issues of funding and permitting don't stand by themselves, because obviously if it takes a couple of years to get something approved, that you may have funding to start with, but at the end of 2 or 3 years, your funding lacks because of time. And so I'm very happy to see that we're thinking about coordinating and getting a permit that could be used for several different projects, be it very similar. So I'm encouraged by this effort. We'll see how it goes as we move forward. But I know in Solano we've had very simple projects. When you get around creeks and rivers, things get complicated, and they're 2 and 3 years old before they even start seeing some light at the end of the tunnel. So I think it's a key issue that needs to be worked on.
Thank you. How long did it take to deliver Dutch Slough? 10 years?
Yeah.
Or more?
More than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to echo the assessment of a great presentation, this is really helpful, and I think it gives us an idea of how complicated this is and how many items and issues you have to focus on. I think I'm hearing questions from the council, and I do have the same questions, and some of us haven't been involved in sort of regulation versus policy versus recommendation. And maybe it gets to, hey, really what are we trying to accomplish here? Because there's things like partnerships and leadership. You can't regulate that. And I think but you can, what can we do? We're not project proponents. You know, a lot of what we do is persuade, convince. But you can require science support for restoration. That could be a policy that would have to be demonstrated in a consistency determination. The permitting support, and I've been through the permitting process, the 404, and one of my first, I'll digress for a second, one of my first projects back in the mid-80s was a restoration project where I learned that you have to mitigate the mitigation, which was like, really? But that's difficult. So, you know, are we looking at, you know, we're proposing an approach, or are we looking at our role is to follow up to try and convince the agencies to have a programmatic permit, because we can't, that's not something we can require or regulate. I wouldn't think that we could say, okay, all of you federal and state permitting agencies figure out a programmatic, but we could certainly try and convince them that and maybe that's part of the alignment that you talked about. So, you know, I think it's helpful. I mean, these are clearly the issues, but I think it's helpful for us to understand, you know, what's our role? How can we help move this forward as you develop the amendment and develop the policies and recommendations? And I don't know, Maria, I think I heard several questions from you also kind of like, you know, okay, what can we regulate here? What can we make them do? And I think that's a discussion as well. There's some things that may be, you know, a regulation, but a lot of some of these issues and implementation are not something you regulate. You've got to strongly recommend, and then what do you do to...
The balance has to happen so that it's impactful. The balance between implementation, coordination, and regulation, and coordination and regulation, has to be such that there's impact, positive impact. And if that balance is not impactful, then you start thinking. And I'm not saying it's not, but that's something that we have to watch for, I think. Yeah.
No, I agree. No, thank you. That was...
All right. Steve's been waiting so patiently. Got here at 8:30 this morning to listen to the music. Steve, I'm going to suggest that we withhold our questions and let you get through your presentation. You can see how inquisitive we are. And I think you have a success story to share with us that's not without its challenges. And we're eager to hear an update on the progress you've made in the Sassoon.
Chairman, council members, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Steve Chappelle, the executive director of the Sassoon Resource Conservation District. I think in September I started my 25th year working in Sassoon. So I'm one of the few folks who sat at the table when we started the Marsh Plan who are now actually implementing it. I would like to express from the other partner agencies their appreciation to be here today and their apologies that due to scheduling constraints, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Department, and the Department of Water Resources were unable to be here, but it's not for a lack of wanting to come to the council. When I was asked to do the presentation, I thought it was important to share a little bit about Sassoon, and it's not the Delta, but it's not the Bay. So without the presentation, what I will be talking about today is the Sassoon Marsh Habitat Management and Restoration Plan. I think what's unique to the plan is you'll note that the Bureau of Reclamation and Fish and Wildlife Service were co-NEPA leads on the environmental document. The Department of Fish and Wildlife was a CEQA lead. It set a path forward for us to do the ongoing operations and maintenance of the managed wetlands in Sassoon, do tidal restoration for ecosystem recovery, and a programmatic approach for the next 30 years. So it is a 30-year plan that addresses existing land use needs in the future. Taking a step back, what is the Sassoon Marsh? It is a unique area between the San Francisco Bay and the Delta. We're just outside the legal jurisdiction of the Delta. There's a small portion of Sassoon that falls within the legal Delta. It is at the confluence of the Sacramento and San Joaquin River. So the eastern side of the marsh is actually freshwater most of the time. The western side of the marsh can be brackish. Anybody who's taken Highway 680, Carquinez Bridge is the western, or the Benicia Bridge is the western edge of the marsh near the mothball fleet. But Sassoon is brackish. In the summer, we have higher salinities. In the winter, the marsh is fresh. It's a very unique ecological area in the estuary or anywhere on the Pacific coast. What was unique about Sassoon is there's also a long history of preservation and protection of these wetlands. Anybody who's talked about native fishes and the problems, X2 is located at Chips Island, which is in Sassoon Marsh. That's the mixing zone between the saltwater and the fresh. It's very critical for a lot of the native fish populations, delta smelt, longfin smelt, but also all the salmonids that use the Central Valley River to spawn. Those juvenile fish outmigrate through Sassoon, and you use that for the smolting process where they go from freshwater to saltwater. So there's a critical component for fisheries in the estuary. Or in marsh. Sassoon historically has been managed for waterfowl habitat. 52,000 acres of the marsh are diked managed wetlands, managed as waterfowl hunting clubs, state wildlife areas, as diked areas that are seasonally irrigated for wintering waterfowl to produce food crops for waterfowl. This is a long hunting heritage as well. What makes Sassoon unique is the mixture of public and private ownership. The map I had before the presentation was about 10 years ago, and I would note on the map all the red is recently acquired lands by the Department of Water Resources for restoration under the Marsh Plan in the last 5 to 6 years. The land in purple is a private property. It was acquired for restoration as well. And then the Department of Fish and Game is the largest landowner in the marsh, about 16,000 acres out of the 116. Significant mosaic and mix of private-public ownership. You can't do something on private land without it being adjacent to a public parcel, but also if you do a public process or a public land activity, you're going to have neighbors that have concerns and issues. I would like to talk a little bit about the history of the marsh, because it really set the stage for a legacy of conservation. Anybody who's taken Amtrak from San Francisco to Sacramento has gone right through Sassoon Marsh. Why would they build a railroad through wetlands? It was to get access to the hunting grounds. Early in the turn of the century, the first waterfowl hunting clubs in California back in the 1880s were in Sassoon Marsh. It was an area where they could go and access waterfowl hunting. So there's a long heritage of that. The Eastern Marsh was actually diked off and farmed. And you have to think about where Sassoon was in the estuary. It was between the gold fields in Sacramento and San Francisco. So there was a lot of commerce that was going back and forth. So there was a lot of agricultural practices where they were exporting dairy products, grain, and fruits to commodities to the major urban centers. With the development of the state and federal water projects in the late 50s and 60s, salinities in Sassoon increased. We started damming the rivers, holding that water back, and metering it out. Agriculture declined in Sassoon, and by the early 60s, most all the agricultural practices had declined. All those areas that were diked had been converted back to seasonal wetlands for waterfowl habitat. In the late 60s, early 70s, many of the landowners in the marsh saw the loss of wetlands in the San Francisco Bay. They had grown up in the San Francisco Bay region and were seeing the bay filled, these wetlands lost. And there was a threat that they saw that Sassoon could suffer the same fate. So they actually went to the state legislature and asked for a plan of protection, a state law that would protect the marsh. In 1974, the Nedgely-Bagley-Zeeberg Act was passed that said we needed a plan to protect the marsh. That plan required the Bay Conservation Development Commission to come up with a land use plan for protecting not only the wetlands, but 27,000 acres of uplands around the marsh. So what's really unique to Sassoon is we not only have a state law that was passed in the late 70s that said we want to protect these resources, but we want to protect the wetland resources and the uplands around that as a buffer from urbanization and encroachment. Very unique. The Preservation Act implemented the plan of protection for BCDC. It also gave Solano County the local land use provisions in the secondary marsh. So there's a local component to the marsh plan of protection that the county has and the cities, so that if anything happens in and around the marsh, there's local land use authority to regulate that for preservation. In the late 70s, the State Water Resources Control Board also adopted salinity standards, which brought the Department of Water Resources and the Bureau into the marsh as a partner in protecting the marsh from salinity intrusion from the water project operations. So as I mentioned, in 1976, BCDC adopted the Sassoon Marsh Protection Plan. What's unique to this is with your authority under the Delta Stewardship Council, now both, I have two state agencies who have joint jurisdictional responsibilities in Sassoon under the Reform Act and the Preservation Act, which is fairly unique. That doesn't happen in other areas of the Delta. Again, the primary and secondary marsh. The primary marsh are the wetland areas below 10-foot in elevation contour. The secondary marsh are the uplands, anything above 10 feet in elevation, Potrero Hills, Montezuma Hills. What was also really critical with the development of the state law is it directed Department of Water Resources to come up with a plan of protection for Sassoon. And really the plan was, how are you going to meet water quality objectives to protect existing beneficial uses? And it set us on a path where DWR and the Bureau have over $100 million investment in facilities in the marsh to meet water quality objectives, including the Montezuma salinity control structures, the Roaring River facilities, the Goodyear Slough Unit. So there's a partnership with the state and federal agencies on how we protect the marsh. In 1980, so we've been moving along in the marsh for 30 years with the existing Preservation Act, and the reality was there were conflicts that occurred around the 2000s when the CalFed program was going on. And the Bureau and DWR were going to do some actions, and actually the Fish and Wildlife Service threatened a jeopardy opinion on the state and federal agencies for the actions they were proposing in the marsh. And this was the era of CalFed where we were all going to get better together. And the CalFed manager stepped in and said, you need to come up with a charter to resolve your differences and come up with a plan to implement those actions and do it in 6 months. The charter took us 6 months at the table, and it was one-page document that said, this is how we'll take our gloves off and actually work together. The Sassoon Marsh Plan implementation element actually took 13 years to develop to its completion. So how did that happen and what was it? The Sassoon Marsh Plan is, again, a 30-year plan. The EIR EIS was completed in 2011. 2013, we signed the record of decision. This included NEPA, CEQA, 1600 permit, a programmatic biological opinion from NOAA Fisheries for the ongoing operations and maintenance of the managed wetlands, a dredging permit for levee maintenance, and a programmatic biological opinion from the services, from both Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries for restoration of 5 to 7,000 acres of tidal wetlands. The conflict that arose at that point is, how do you do this? The plan is the central, but when you realize that if the Fish and Wildlife Service's tidal marsh recovery plan is targeted at recovering listed species, you have to take managed wetlands out of managed wetlands and restore them back to tidal wetlands. So there's land use changes that are occurring. A restoration project likely going to need to build up an interior levee, upgrade levee. So they needed programmatic permits to do levee improvements, get through the 404 and the 401 as part of their restoration planning. So sitting at the table and trying to look at how do you implement each of the agency's unique objectives and responsibilities, there was a needed shared plan of how to do that. And it's the idea that nobody got what they wanted, but everybody got enough to get what they needed. And that was the compromise. How did we achieve that? It was a dedication of agencies sitting at the table for the whole process. You can see that the Bureau, Reclamation, Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA Fisheries, SRCD, DWR, Fish and Game, and the Delta Stewardship Council, CBDA, and CalFed, the predecessors, were all at the table as the principal agencies. We met twice a month for 4 to 6 hours a month. The other agencies that were involved, we had regulatory agencies. So you couldn't do that in a vacuum without the ability to actually get the Corps of Engineers permit, the regional board certification. So we had to have other people as regulatory agencies, but they weren't actively participating as principal agencies. As part of the charter, we agreed that it would be a consensus-based process. We weren't going to have anybody at the table, federal government being the Bureau or the service or NOAA Fisheries, they had veto power. As the Resource Conservation District, I was representing the local landowners, and I really pushed back on trying to develop specific maps that called out specific parcels. We came up with a strategy where we identified regions of the marshes and targets so that if a landowner chose to stay, he could continue to operate and maintain his property with all of the environmental clearances and permits. If a landowner chose that he wanted to sell to an agency for restoration, there was a path forward for future land use, but it was with willing seller only. That I could not get into a situation where we had a plan that called for condemnation of private land. So I think when you start looking at sub-regional plans, when you start identifying specific parcels, if that landowner is not a willing participant, you're going to go down a path where there's conflict and litigation. The Sassoon Marsh to this date has not suffered from litigation because we've had willing sellers and a path forward for those landowners that want to stay. I think that's a critical component. And at the end of the day, each of the principal agencies got what they needed from a regulatory perspective, from a habitat management perspective, from land use, but also recovery needs. We were fortunate that the Fish and Wildlife Service was developing their tidal marsh recovery plan concurrently with the marsh plan so that those two are almost interchangeable in their objectives, so there's not conflicts there. How do you look at, so we completed the plan in 2013. We're actually moving into implementation now, and I'm going to move the next step is into the implementation. How do you do that? Active agency participation. You can't implement a program without people at the table with a vested interest. We continue to have monthly meetings at high-level staff. You can't have lower-level staff that says, well, I can't speak for the agency. I have to go back and get an answer. And then you wait a month for an answer. We have high-level managers that continue to sit at the table, and if issues are raised, we can elevate them. Very critical. And then as a result of the Stewardship Council and the CBDA, when the Marsh Plan was developed, we had a robust science element. We had conceptual models for each of the implementation elements. We have an adaptive management plan that was part of the plan, and we have a rigorous adaptive management process. So right now we have quarterly adaptive management meetings, which the Stewardship Council and Department of Fish and Wildlife jointly lead up that effort. And then we're looking at ongoing monitoring. We have a pretty long-term monitoring program. So this is the Sassoon Marsh, 116,000 acres, 52,000 acres of diked wetlands, 6,000 acres of tidal wetlands, and about 27,000 acres of uplands. You can see within each of the planning regions, which were more geographically associated with hydrology in the planning, is that there's a range of targets. So we knew you couldn't anticipate where everything was going to happen in time, but we gave ourselves some ranges and flexibility for implementation with a target of 5,000 to 7,000 acres over the next 30 years.
I'm sorry, the regions, the colors are the high elevation issue, right? That's how you do it. What's the basis of the regions?
The regions were tied more to the hydrology, so the local slough channels and salinity. So the region one is kind of the western marsh where we have higher salinities. Region three is Grizzly Island. It's the Montezuma Slough is really the boundary. So there was hydrology and salinity was one of the major factors in that and ownership. So when I say everybody got something that they needed from the landowners, the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the private landowners in the marsh, I have a regional general permit that allows duck clubs to continue to operate and maintain their facilities, a five-year general permit, and five renewals of that for 30 years. So they know they have stable regulatory environment. If they want to be a duck club, they can operate and maintain their facilities. I can get a permit in 45 days from the Corps for them to do routine maintenance activities as a result of the marsh plan. It's also I had a long-term history of administering that permit with them prior to the marsh plan. We were also issued a dredging permit. I've challenged you to find a 10-year dredging permit for levee maintenance in the estuary right now. That is to support the landowner's ongoing levee maintenance activities. So the Resource Conservation District administers that permit and does all the environmental compliance on behalf of the private landowners and state agencies that are utilizing it. What's important for ecosystem restoration is we did a programmatic EIR, EIS for tidal restoration activities. So we looked at restoration, 5,000 to 7,000 acres, did a programmatic analysis, and did a NEPA and CEQA document and have programmatic biological opinions. As a site comes in, it's acquired from a private landowner, there is a site-specific analysis, and then the project moves forward, but you're tearing off of these programmatic documents. So for the next project that we're looking at here, this map's a little washed out, but we do have Chips Island, the Bradmore Island, Tule Red, which I believe is a project that's come before the Council for Consistency Determination, the Hill Slough Project, which is Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then Wings Landing. These are all projects that are ongoing for restoration planning or actually in construction. They tiered off of the programmatic biological opinion. I think Tule Red got their permits in about a year and a half or 2 years, and the same with Hill Slough. So when you look at Dutch Slough, who took 10 to 12 years for permitting, because we had these programmatic documents, the marsh plan took us 10 years, but now we're able to go to implementation of site-specific projects in 2 to 3 years from permitting to initiating construction. So this is the Tule Red restoration design. They started construction 2 summers ago. I believe they're scheduled to breach the levee next fall and enter a management with starting a starter channel. The Bradmore Island tidal restoration design. What's unique to this is it's actually the acquisition of 4 private parcels. So Department of Water Resources had purchased 1 parcel and were doing interim management until they could acquire the other 2 parcels on the island. But because it made more sense from restoration design, instead of designing a one parcel restoration, doing the whole island was more reasonable. So it took 3 to 4 years of development of going through acquisition and acquiring it, but now we're doing a restoration plan for the entire island, which is more cost effective and reduces long-term maintenance and construction costs, and ecologically is important. So these are the types of actions that you can implement under the Sassoon Marsh Plan because we have programmatic biological opinions and agency coordination. Lastly, I'll get to the Sassoon Marsh Adaptive Management Advisory Team. As part of the science element of the Marsh Plan, we were having project proponents come in and come to the Adaptive Management Team. And I have to say, the first year and a half, it was kind of like being called into the principal's office. And the applicants are, well, what do you want to know? Well, they'd answer you. It was like they were giving a deposition, as opposed to having an open interaction. So we actually went back, kind of did after a year, we did a soul-searching effort to say, how is this adaptive management plan advisory team serving the project proponents as well as our agency needs? And we really overhauled the process and developed it to a four-phase process. And that's, if you acquire a process, come in early and meet with us. And the agencies take off their regulatory hat and become advisors. So we're not giving you regulatory guidance, but we're saying your site is well suited for this this ecological function. You might want to think about these physical constraints. You have infrastructure like pipelines on your property. You have flood risk to your neighboring landowners. You may have impact on salinities. These are the types of things you need to build into your early project design. They come back to us at 40% design. And so there's an iterative process where we see project proponents, as they're working through, they raise issues, they can come back to the respective agencies that they're tearing off of our environmental document and get feedback till they get to their final permit application. One of the things that I'm hopeful that we can do is, as we move into permit submittal, is actually support good science. I can tell you, as a project proponent, many permits come with long lists of terms and conditions. There's standard monitoring. Go out there, and when you a restoration project will look at it, and they may have $100,000 worth of biological monitoring just to meet their permit compliance. Why don't we look at specific sites and say, we have scientific uncertainties in the estuary about how these sites, these restored sites, are going to contribute to the recovery of listed species. This would be a really good site to answer this question, and put the weight of the adaptive management team behind the project proponent when they go to their permits and say, maybe doing all of this general monitoring that just complies with permit, can we focus the monitoring to actually answer science and inform future restoration design and success criteria? So I think that's where we really have an opportunity to move these projects forward through implementation and then have good monitoring to see, to tell whether we're successful and learn from our mistakes. We're not going to get them right, all of them right, and learn from our successes to make sure that the next project in line is actually getting the benefit of that knowledge. But what I find is the project proponents tend to be kind of siloed, and there's not that interaction between a project proponent at Site A and Site B. That's the value of the adaptive management team, because we're all actively engaged. So
I just have a question about the slide before this. When you talk about interim management, control of invasive species, when you say interim, that means that it stopped at some point? No. And then what were the actions?
So back to that original matrix where I showed the marsh plan, and you have levees, right, and recovery. Right. One of the things that I've seen from an agency perspective is there's a complete disassociation with restoration objectives and outcomes. And that is, well, we bought it and we want to restore it. Well, in that 3 to 5 year process, you have all these ongoing activities as a landowner that, mm-hmm, you have to do. You have trespass, you have violations, mm-hmm, or maintenance needs, levees need maintenance, water control structures fail. So what we're learning is that when you acquire a site for restoration, they don't want to invest in it because they're going to tear the levees down at some point. But you have to invest or else the site will fail on its own or go to an outcome that you don't want. So the regional general permit that I hold for the private landowners not only allows the agencies doing restoration to do interim management, but they can operate it and actually start managing it in a way that puts it on a trajectory for the restoration. So if it's seasonally managed, maybe you flood it year-round and promote tall emergent vegetation. So when you restore it, you already have vegetation on the site.
So with interim, you mean because then the condition around it changes, the infrastructure or whatever around it changes, so therefore that's why you call them interim.
So the interim is from acquisition to a fully permitted restoration where they breach the levee, you're going to have actions in between. We can do those actions in between to actually get our outcomes a kickstart. We're heading in the right direction before we ever get there when the project's implemented and permitted.
And when you said control of invasive species, that was exactly what?
Here at the bottom of my notes, moving forward with implementation, one of the things is most of these wetland areas in the estuary are highly invaded with non-native species. Non-native species control is not very sexy. It's expensive. It's labor-intensive. It's really hard to get the resources to say if we want natural communities and we want to recover these habitats, they can't be invaded by non-native species. Mm-hmm. So we need to do the control and removal prior restoration, so we're likely to set the outcomes in a good positive direction as opposed to just saying, well, it's already invaded. If we breach a levee, we can't control its outcome. Okay. So that's one of the big things that we're looking at now in early implementation is how do you address invasive species prior to breaching the levees and the ongoing operations.
Thank you.
And Steve, you're talking almost all about plants, right? Invasive plants.
Yes. Yeah. That's predominantly Phragmites, Salicylata, Lepidium, which are throughout the estuary and problematic. Yeah. So,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm almost to the end, so we can kind of.
No, I just is that a restoration protocol now? I'm trying to, is it adaptive management, or are you saying when you do a restoration project, one of your initial steps is to remove invasives?
I think it's a lesson learned from early implementation, and that Thule Red didn't do as much of it. They had Phragmites on the site. They've done some control, but they're moving forward with restoration. At Bradmore Island, which is the next project that's currently in planning, DWR is taking an active role. And actually, if Cliff were here, he could he's a project manager for those programs. I believe they've slid their restoration timeline back to give themselves a year or two to do invasive species control because they think that you'll get better outcomes for the long-term project by taking a year to do invasive species control. So it's lessons learned.
So it's lessons learned as you're designing?
Yes.
So if you're coming, I'm thinking of how, we would put it in the amendment. Is that something we want to see is you come in with a design, and if you've identified invasive plants, you're addressing those before you complete the project? Or why wouldn't you do that in the – why is that a lesson learned?
Well, it's more of a reality. My concern is when you start putting prescriptive – when you prescribe that you shall control invasive species, many of these, then you get into the, well, what's the definition of invasive and what's native and non-native? Because you can have a really nice upland, but it's highly invaded with non-native good upland plants. We're never going to go back to pre-European colonization in this estuary. But there are some known stressors, ecological things that are degrading the ecology of these functioning wetlands, that we know if we could remove them early, we would get better ecological outcomes. But the restoration sites are going to be invaded, whether they're already invaded or in the future, and we need to have in our adaptive management plan, not only once you've restored it, but how are you going to address it moving forward? And DWR is actively doing some grant solicitation for Proposition $1 to look at invasive species controlled in tidal areas, so once they restore these sites, if they become invaded, what would be the best treatments?
So it's situational.
Yes, site-specific.
Site-specific,
but
project by project.
The adaptive management process where you bring project proponents in multiple times and even post-construction lessons learned is the idea that the agencies should be helping future projects avoid the same mistakes and how we were successful at addressing this problem. And it could be a permitting approach that this site has this constraint and this would be very costly to deal with. Well, so in the marsh we have endangered species considerations like salt marsh harvest mouse. There's hand clearing responsibilities for the breach site. Well, what if you brought in goats and you actually remove, you know, could you use grazing as an alternative to an expensive strategy for hand clearing? Well, that takes a year advanced knowledge to get, you know, so there's those opportunities that we're looking at of how do you comply with your environmental restrictions and programmatic biological opinion constraints. They've set out a path and some ways that we've, through implementation, have found to streamline those and address cost savings, effectiveness, and better outcomes.
Thank you.
That was the end of my presentation.
You almost made it to the end without a question. All right. John, did you want to?
Sure. I was just going to say thank you so much for highlighting the role of science and emphasizing, in addition to adaptive management being critical within a project, adaptive management across projects, because I think learning as we go is really the goal, the larger goal of adaptive management beyond just fine-tuning individual projects. And I think Steve took the Independent Science Board on a tour of Bradmore Island last fall, a year ago, just about a year ago, and it was really interesting for them to see the challenges of restoration within Sassoon, both at Broadmoor and then at some of the other areas farther down into the marsh.
Yeah.
And I think it would be very useful for some, if the council would be interested, I think in addition to seeing, you know, those of you who went to the South Delta this summer, I think it's really interesting to see the marsh opportunities in Sassoon or Cosumnes or somewhere where there's very different conditions than in other parts of the Delta.
I think it would be good to schedule that because the presentations today are so complementary. It's probably not accurate to say that what Ron and Jessica have provided is aspirational, but it's sort of forward-looking. And Steve has described operational. He's gone from this regional permit to now implementing that and actually making changes. So I think as we're struggling with what kind of changes do we want to bring to the ecosystem chapter, your presentation today, Steve, was spot on. And I noted how many answers you provided to the questions that had been asked previously. So there was a really good linkage, and I compliment staff for putting this discussion together. Skip, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, thanks. You know, we in Solano County are very proud of the Sassoon Marsh, so you see why, based on Steve's presentation. You know, one of the things that we were talking about was the permitting, and I think Steve proved why coordination and not an adversarial relationship between permitting agencies and those that are trying to put a project forward really benefit not only in this case Sassoon but the Delta as a whole. I mean, as we fight over who's responsible, who's going to issue permits, things are happening in the Bay, in the Delta, that aren't good. So as time marches on, things could get worse. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that on the other side of the county, the Cache Slough Management Plan is something that we really have been looking at trying to get implemented, and we would like to say maybe Sassoon is an example that we can follow. A lot of lessons learned, and the Cache Slough certainly could benefit from those lessons. So I'd hope that the council would look favorably at that Cache Slough Management Plan and help us achieve the goals that were achieved in Sassoon. But I wanted to thank you for the presentation. It was great, and we're always happy to brag about Solano and Sassoon Marsh.
Well, and I have to say, I think the state legislation in the late 70s under the Sassoon Marsh Preservation Act really set us on a different trajectory than other regions that kind of are autonomous to their own masters. We have a structure through the county and BCDC for existing land use, so we don't have urban encroachment, we don't have pressures. And we don't have active agriculture where you're looking at taking farm families and putting them out of business for restoration. But I can tell you I've had the conversation where putting a duck club out of business for restoration is no more desirable to me than it is to a farming family. Some of these properties have been in their family ownership for over 100 years. So tradition and legacy is important, and to dismiss that when you're doing planning, and that's why the Marsh Plan, we did regional maps with targets. So there is flexibility in implementation. You're not calling out one individual parcel and causing conflict. And I think the success of the Marsh Plan has been this ability, if you want to stay and continue to do what you're doing, there's a path forward that's streamlined and easy. If you want to go, there's a golden parachute and a way out where a project proponent come in and can do restoration and do it quickly and meet our plan objectives. And that's really where the balance of the Marsh Plan is unique. But it is sub-regional, and I would say I do have a seat on the Delta Conservancy Board as a liaison advisor. I think that looking at the Delta plan and trying to address every area of the Delta with one policy is going to be difficult, where Cache Slough and Yolo is a lot different than the Central Delta, and you may need to look at some sub-regional approaches because of urbanization and different conflicts to be successful. So you don't have one policy that fits all. You have policies, but how you implement those may be a little different based on regional needs.
Of course.
I just wanted to underscore the invitation to visit the Sioux City Marsh. I mean, I think that's very, very important for us.
Yeah.
Really, really important. Operational aspect that you described, and given what we've just heard this morning, I just think it's critical for us to physically go there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Agreed. We're glad to host you whenever we can make it happen.
So, Steve, you had earlier talked about conflicts, and the charter was used to address them or resolve them. So was it the duck club ownership and restoration, was that sort of the conflict? And what was the thing, what happened, you know, was there a single factor besides, hey, it's all about wildlife and birds, and you kind of aligned on that, but was there anything else that brought you all together?
It was a shotgun wedding that brought us together. But the conflict was basically that the ongoing operations of the duck club, the dike managed wetlands, were not supporting tidal restoration activities for recovery of listed species. And that if we were to continue to do our operations and maintenance to not do any restoration, that there we weren't contributing to recovery. Because of the Bureau and Department of Water Resources partnership in the Marsh, they had facilities that they had to maintain, and there was going to be mitigation for those effects. So the question was, how do we move forward in the next 30 years with the existing facilities being operated and maintained and the existing land use, but also contribute to recovery? And that's, you have to understand, we were also developing this in the time of BDCP, where we're looking at 100,000 acres of habitat restoration in the estuary, and Sassoon was included in part of those restoration areas. So 5,000 to 7,000 acres was a drop in the bucket compared to what was really being proposed under BDCP. So, you know, there's politics involved in that as well. But I did find you walk a mile in someone else's shoes, in that having the Fish and Wildlife Service and the NOAA fisheries people and the ESA branch and the land use folks to go out on the land and look at the activities and really were they significant to the environment. And at the end of the day, I always said, in Sassoon, the private landowners are continuing to maintain these managed wetlands. They'll always be available for future tidal restoration when they, you know, if it's not cost effective. So why don't we prop up and support the stewardship of the marsh, and then with willing sellers, when appropriate or dollars are available, we're going to get restoration and good planned restoration. You don't want levee failure, because if you have levee failures, then you get bad outcomes on all, you know. So that's this idea is, let's maintain the resources we have and let's do wise planning for restoration where it's appropriate. There are sites that aren't, ecologically or physically appropriate for restoration, or there's infrastructure that would make restoration infeasible, you don't want those areas to fail because we can't maintain them. So it's striking that balance is all, and how we manage the marsh as a resource as opposed to individual projects.
Oh, okay. No, that's very helpful.
I had one question. When you talked about the duck farm and all that, what are the tools through which you deal with this kind of activities to stop them? Or, for example, I mean, like in land use, it's eminent domain. Or, I mean, what are the kind of legal tools for, or it's all negotiation?
I think the Sassoon Marsh Preservation Act was really the instrument by which the Bay Conservation Development Commission has policies and regulations for existing land use, so does Solano County. Each duck club has a certified duck club management plan as a result of the 1980 or the late 70s activities. And as long as you're maintaining those facilities as called for in your management plan, you don't need special BCDC permits. If you do development, then you would get a BCDC permit. The tools that we have are levee maintenance, water control structure maintenance. We're basically farming duck food. We irrigate.
No, the tools to stop. I mean, the tools to
the tools to stop encroachment was really the Preservation Act in 77.
Act. Okay.
And that's why I said we're at a unique situation because we don't see. I mean, but the Delta Protection Commission, my understanding is even DPC's policies were kind of mirrored after Sassoon because Sassoon Marsh was adopted and then DPC followed it shortly thereafter. And it was a little different, but they used the same. Some of the staff that worked at BCDC and did the marsh plan were working at Delta Protection Commission when the policies were adopted.
Yeah, that works.
So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Lita, do we have any requests for public comment? All right. Then, Steve, thanks for devoting so much time to this. Very important in our process to help inform us. And we appreciate the good examples you're setting out there. Ron, thank you. Jessica, thank you. That completes file item number 8. We have one more item to go. I'm going to move right into file item number 10, and that's the lead scientist report. Skip is leaving. No disrespect to our lead scientist.
What's
of course.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Fiorini. And I know I am the only thing between you and lunch, so I will try to be quick. But there are some important things that I wanted to highlight in the report this month. So first, something that's not in your binder but that we wanted to update you on is a contract that was recently signed for the Monitoring Enterprise Review. So I think you know that the Independent Science Board is, as one of their current reviews, is undertaking a review of all of the monitoring efforts that are occurring within the Delta. And as part of that, and to help inform the ISB's review, the council put out a request for proposals back a few months ago to bring on a contractor to complete a inventory and survey of all of the monitoring efforts that are occurring within the Delta, and not just to categorize them, but to look at why that monitoring is being done, how it links to the kinds of decisions that are occurring, where it's occurring, how frequently. Mm-hmm. And so that RFP we just recently completed. We interviewed a number of strong candidates, and we we're in the midst of finalizing the contract with ESSA Technologies, ESSA Technologies, from British Columbia, which is a leading consulting firm that's worked, one of the founders of the adaptive management efforts really helped to develop that company. So they have a strong link to monitoring and adaptive management, and I'm sure their efforts will be very well received by the Independent Science Board and the broader science community. So that contract is just now being completed. Their work will start in December, and they will work through December of 2019. So as they get underway and have some more information, we will update you on their work. Another thing that isn't in the binder, but I just wanted to mention briefly, Judge Damrell, you had asked, you brought up the news article that came out on the day of our last meeting about impacts to salmon in the Northwest and temperature issues, and a recent ruling that came down. from a federal judge in the Northwest. And that ruling requires that EPA come up with a plan for managing temperatures on the Columbia and the Snake River. Over 250,000 adult salmon were killed due to high temperatures in 2015, and a lawsuit was placed following that occurrence. So there isn't any immediate direct linkages. That the ruling is really specific to the Snake and the Columbia River, but it definitely highlights the importance of temperature issues. The surprising thing there was the impact to adult fish. The juvenile and the eggs are much more sensitive, and the focus here in our watershed is really more on temperature impacts on eggs and juvenile fish, and there actually is a significant component of the biological opinion, the actions out of the biological opinions that do focus on maintaining temperature and using water releases from the dams to control temperatures to provide the appropriate conditions for salmon. So there definitely are some linkages there, but no immediate issues. But if other things come up, I'd be happy to update you on that. So with that, I want to go into some of the items that are in the summary report. And I'm going to change the order and start first with the recent report that came out on global warming from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN's effort to look to have a broad-scale review of climate change that's been ongoing for decades. The IPCC is the acronym that's used for that. So they put out a report just six weeks ago on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. I'd say this report has the longest title. I included it on your report just because it's the longest and probably the worst title I've ever seen for a report. Surprising from the IPCC because they're very aware of communicating science and making it effective to across a broad range of audiences. But the report really looks at that issue of the goal for the IPCC, the long-term goal has been to keep temperature increases to 2 degrees Celsius, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. At the Paris signing a few years ago, a number of countries raised the issue that 2 degrees is actually very significant, and we should be more focusing on 1.5 degrees, and we should be really thinking about doing all we can to reduce climate change even more than we already are. I think, as Randy mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, the recent fires really highlight these enormous impacts that are occurring, and if we don't do something about climate change, what we're setting ourselves up to be the new abnormal or normal that we are going to be facing. And I think in the media coverage around this report, really all of the focus was around the urgency of this issue, that we really need to get serious about climate change, or we are going to we already are seeing dramatic changes, and they are happening much more quickly than anyone might have predicted. So the report highlights the changes that are already occurring. We've had a temperature increase globally of almost 1 degree Celsius, so we're on our way towards 1.5. They highlight that if we don't do something, even if we do something quickly, we're going to reach 1.5 degrees Celsius in the next 20 years. And then 2 degrees will follow another 20 years after that. And so I can say from a personal experience, when I was started doing my master's, the first project I ever worked on was on climate change impacts to bay wetlands in the late 80s, and it was an EPA-sponsored report, one of the first efforts to look at climate change impacts on coastal wetlands. I always thought, you know, this is something that's sort of out there that's really not going to affect me so much. Same when I started teaching students in the 90s, I always would say climate change for someone like me is, you know, it's definitely of interest, but it's the younger generations that it's really going to affect. But I think what we're seeing is it's happening much more quickly, and it truly is affecting us already. So they highlight the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees really are substantial. Some of the differences the report highlights are the likelihood of the Arctic Ocean being free of ice with 1.5 degrees Celsius increase. That being free of ice is likely to happen once a century. With 2 degrees Celsius, it's likely to happen once a decade. So dramatic changes there. Corals will go from a 70 to 90% decline from pre-industrial populations to being pretty much wiped out with 2 degrees Celsius, 99% decline of corals. Sea level rise will increase significantly more with 2 degrees Celsius, and the quicker we can address sea level rise, the more time we have to deal with adaptation issues and other things. In terms of human impacts, they identify that in terms of extreme heat exposure, extreme heat events like we had in Europe a couple summers ago, that those events are likely to go from to affect 14% of the population every 5 years at 1.5 degrees Celsius. If we go to 2 degrees, it would be 37%. So more than double, almost triple the number of people would be exposed to extreme heat events if we go to 2 degrees Celsius. So all of those are just examples of how big of a change there will be. They identify, if we're going to get serious about it, they're actually that we need to really dramatically reduce emissions and get to, in order to get to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we need to get to zero emissions by 2030. So we aren't anywhere near that, but that they're identifying how big of a change is necessary in order to do that. If we don't, then we will we'll continue to increase at a really rapid rate and then have to do something more to reduce it. So they identify, you know, reducing emissions, looking at other ways, carbon capture technologies that are being developed, but there's much more of an opportunity to develop them and use some of those different technologies to address that. Other things that they point out is that the differential impacts of climate change across the globe, and it's really poor communities that are more likely to be more severely impacted by climate change, and that so not only technologically but ethically there's a real push to try to deal with this. So those are the not so happy but really challenging things to think about, and that urgency issue of addressing climate change. Any comments or questions? Okay, so the other report that I included in the summary relates directly to what you just heard about with Sassoon Marsh, because it deals with salt marsh harvest mouse recovery. And this is actually a summary of two articles that were done by Catherine Smith, a PhD student who's just finishing up at UC Davis and who actually was a Delta Science Fellow and did all of this work as a Delta Science Fellow. And she's really become one of the experts locally on the salt marsh harvest mouse. Salt marsh harvest mouse is a rare and local species that only occurs within San Francisco, in the San Francisco estuary, in the bay, and Sassoon. It doesn't occur in freshwater marshes. It occurs in brackish and salt marshes in Sassoon and the bay. It's endangered because so much of the habitat has been lost. So with 90% loss of wetlands, that's its habitat. And so it's been listed since the 1970s and has been a target of restoration and management efforts in the bay for a long history. It actually is relatively recent that it was found in greater numbers in Sassoon, but now people have realized that actually the population in Sassoon Marsh is a significant component of the overall population within the bay. And so this paper goes through and identifies what some of the current knowledge is around the salt marsh harvest mouse, what the restoration opportunities are for the harvest mouse, and what some of the unknowns or uncertainties are that we need to address. And the harvest mouse occurs in the upper edge of the marsh, so a lot of what we've talked about in terms of restoration issues really focuses on the aquatic species, the fish or invertebrates in the water. And the harvest mouse is interesting because it's sort of on the edge of the marsh and the terrestrial habitat. So since it needs air, if when the marsh is flooded, it needs to move to higher ground. And so Sassoon Marsh is definitely one of the areas where there is, as Steve Chappelle was saying, there's marsh and adjacent terrestrial habitats. And so there's areas that are currently good habitat for the mouse. And if sea level rises and more areas are flooded, will continue to be good habitat. So some of the uncertainties are those issues around climate change, how to manage habitat for the mouse currently, and then think about opportunities around climate change. A number of other recommendations are made around understanding their population and genetic issues, understanding where this species, how this species does in natural areas, as well as in all of those managed marshes that occur within Sassoon, and understanding population dynamics there. And then other issues looking at pollutant and contaminant impacts, and then understanding the role of its interactions with other species within the marsh. So I included this just because I think it makes us think about not just the aquatic system, but also that terrestrial land linkage, and also highlights, although we've talked a lot about ecosystem issues rather than species-specific issues, this species really gives us a good understanding of that upper part of the marsh. So although it's species-focused, it really has many, many ecosystem benefits. So any questions or any thoughts on the harvest mouth? Everyone's hungry and ready for lunch, I think so. I have one last summary to do, and then we'll hear by the numbers. So the last summary is about the brown bag seminar that Jeff Mount gave just a few weeks ago on ecosystem water budgets, a novel approach to managing water in the environment. And I think most of you are very familiar with Jeff Mount's work and the work that PPIC, the Public Policy Institute of California, has done. And so he was presenting an overview of one of their recent reports looking at this idea of ecosystem water budgets. He identified, you know, the problems around current water management and proposed ecosystem water budgets that have been proposed in the past, but he went into some details of what how they might be implemented. Ecosystem water budgets, he identified that he defined them as quantities of water in a watershed that can be flexibly managed in order to meet ecosystem goals. He highlighted that in order for these water budgets to be useful, they have to be managed like a priority water right. They need to have clearly identified ecosystem goals that are trying to be achieved with that water. They need to be managed by an ecosystem trustee, an individual who is responsible for those management decisions, and that would be making those decisions and also held responsible for their impacts. And then another key point is the opportunity for water trading and storage so that there's some flexibility in how those water budgets are managed. He highlighted these efforts have been – a similar approach has been used in Australia looking at – and what's worked there is a watershed scale approach with an annual water plan or annual watering plan to identify how water might be used with contingencies so that you could adjust the plan as you move through the year. And then he also identified the need that we need to improve overall water accounting practices. And in the report, he identified that the way we should be looking at the way we're accounting for water is the water that's diverted out of the system, the water that he refers to as system water that's used to flow, to maintain conditions within the ecosystem, to maintain salinity in the estuary or in the delta. And then ecosystem water that's beyond that is used for ecosystem benefits, and then uncaptured water that is the water that we don't really manage, that just moves through the system because we don't have the capacity to manage it. So looking at water in that way and using this approach, he feels we could make some significant advances in the way we're managing our water. And I think we had a chance to talk with him after his presentation about the linkages of those ideas and the ecosystem amendment and the water component of the ecosystem amendment, where there's definitely a lot of parallels to what he's proposing and what we're thinking about. Any questions?
Did anyone ask during the brown bag about the uncaptured water and whether or not that uncaptured water could go to groundwater replenishment?
I don't know that anyone did ask that, but he did discuss the linkage to groundwater. Randy, you might remember.
Yeah, he referenced the Tuolumne River
many times.
And certainly there's an opportunity in the white area east of the Turlock Modesto Irrigation Districts for groundwater replenishment. So I think he indirectly cited the sigma as a driver of change of water that historically has been released for to maintain flood control space that could otherwise be reallocated for groundwater. So, yeah, indirectly he did discuss that.
Great. Okay, I will turn it over to Amanda Wasserman, who will give us by the numbers.
Thanks, John. All right, good afternoon, Chair Fiorini and council members. Here are the numbers for the month of November. So neither the northern nor central Sierra regions have received any more precipitation this month. Thus, current levels are well below average for this time of year, at 19 and 21% of average, respectively. Correspondingly, there is still no snowpack to report. And for the first time this year, we're seeing that water temperatures at all sites are consistently 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Storages at Shasta, Oroville, and San Luis reservoirs all remain similar to last month at 80, 51, and 106% of average, respectively. And repairs to the Oroville infrastructure were completed by the beginning of this month. We're seeing some interesting patterns in flow this month. While both the average flow in the Sacramento River and average exports appear to have decreased this month compared to last month, average flow in the San Joaquin River has actually increased. While decreases in flow and exports can likely be explained by conservative water management practices to prepare for what may be another dry year, we are less certain of an explanation for increased flows in the San Joaquin. One possibility could be reservoir releases to reduce salinity in this river. Speaking of salinity, if you recall from last month, I told you that the way each of these numbers was reported was a little different, so we couldn't really make a true comparison between them, and that was because we used to not have access to the same data that we do now. So as promised, I went in and altered this so that the data now represent consistent methods of collection across all three sites, and so now we can better compare them to one another. And they are all now monthly averages of salinity, whereas before these top two numbers here were more daily snapshots rather than averages across the whole month. So turns out that the salinity in the Sacramento River really didn't change after this alteration, meaning that it's staying more consistent throughout the month. However, we saw that salinity in the San Joaquin jumped up quite a bit immediately after making this change. And at the beginning of this month, it was actually closer to 400 microsiemens per centimeter, and now it's decreased to 338. And finally, salinity at Banks Pumping Plant was already reported as a monthly average, so we did not need to change anything, and the value here is almost exactly the same as last month. As you've noticed, I've also added a map here to this slide. And sorry, it's a little fuzzy. Hope you can make out the stations there. Hopefully you can get the idea. So last month, a question came up as to why the salinity at Vernalis was so much lower than at Banks. Well, first of all, turns out that there's not quite as great of a difference as we thought. But at the same time, if we look at this map, we can see that the Vernalis station is fairly upriver along the San Joaquin compared to the Banks Pumping Plant. So where Vernalis is, there's fresh water flowing down, but there really isn't much tidal action in that area that would push more saline water up. And then if you look at Banks, that station is pumping water that is more or less circulated more throughout the delta, which has not only taken up water from the bay, but also water that has drained from agricultural fields, which is also higher in salinity. So I'm certainly no expert on this topic, but that's kind of our best guess as to what might be happening here, and I'd love to hear any of your thoughts as well. Okay, so moving on to the back page of the handout, and also this is the last slide. At the DPIC meeting last week, we heard from Paul Souza, who indicated that initial salmon returns looked promising at the Coleman National Fish Hatchery along Battle Creek. So we did a little digging to get some of these numbers for you, and here they are. To date, approximately 13,500 fall run Chinook salmon have returned to the hatchery, leading to a preliminary estimate of 23,000 salmon returning to Battle Creek this year. And this value would be the highest in several years. It's likely that we are just now seeing the returns from conditions immediately following the drought, since Battle Creek salmon are on a 3-year spawning cycle. And lastly, the hatchery has already met its egg collection targets and will achieve its release target of 12 million fall Chinook salmon smolts this coming spring. So that's all I have for you today. Thanks for listening, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Amanda? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your enthusiasm.
Jessica? Just a quick note. While we were meeting today, we did get another certification of consistency filed with the council, and this is from the South Sacramento Habitat Conservation Plan. There are 6 permit applicants, which include Sacramento County, the City of Galt, the City of Rancho Cordova, and Sacramento County Water Agency, and others. It's essentially a 50-year permitting framework that will allow for conservation activities and also the accommodation of planned future land use and development as described in the plan. So that kicks off a 30-day review period, which will end on December 14th. And that information, including the detailed certificate, is available on our website.
Seems timely, given the discussion today. Thank you for that. John, anything further?
No, that completes our report.
Okay, great. And Lita, any requests for public comment? All right, then we have reached the end of the agenda for today. Tomorrow we will resume at 9 o'clock to convene a workshop to discuss the staff's draft findings regarding the Department of Water Resources California Water Fix Project. So we are now in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning here. Thank you for coming.